Okay, let's go ahead and open up to Matthew 17. Wow, I'm all messed up. Let's open up to Matthew 17. We're going to finish up Matthew 17. And it's important for us to realize what's going on here in these, especially from Matthew 16, 17. He's bringing out this unbelief component. They aren't listening to Jesus. They aren't listening. And so that's going to be something that they're going to have to start doing. And of course, we know they do it in force after the resurrection. But Jesus wants them to start doing that now. And in chapter 17, we're going to see outlined three different groups of people who still aren't listening to Jesus. And it's going to start with Peter and the 12. Peter and the 12 aren't listening in faith with regard to Jesus' instruction that he must suffer at the hands of his own people, die an ignominious death on the cross, and then be raised from the dead. Everything in chapter 7 flows out of chapter 16, and really one verse in specific, and that's verse 21. So let's just refresh our memory with Matthew 16, verse 21. From that time forth began Jesus to show unto his disciples how that he must go unto Jerusalem. He must suffer many things at the hands of his own people, the elders, the chief priests, the scribes, the Pharisees, Sadducees, by the vain religious system, and be killed and be raised again on the third day. That's what he's going to begin to teach them. That's what they needed to listen to in faith. It wasn't that they weren't hearing his words, it's that they weren't embracing his words in faith. They were rejecting it. And you're going to see now several instances of this as we work our way through Matthew 17. Let's look at the first instance, and then I'll get the ball rolling here. When we see what's Peter's response to this, and he really, you know, Peter's the spokesman for the 12. So if Peter's saying this, the whole 12 are thinking of this. Look at verse 22. Did Peter listen? Verse 22 of chapter 16. Then Peter took him and began to rebuke him. He's rebuking Jesus for what he just said. And what does he say? He says, be it far from thee, Lord, this shall not be unto thee. Jesus is trying to tell him what's coming up down the road. He doesn't say, I might have to go to Jerusalem and suffer. He doesn't say, it's probably going to happen. He says, it has to happen. It must happen. This is the reason Jesus came in his earthly ministry, to go to that cross. And he begins teaching that to Peter and the 12, and Peter says, rebukes him and says, this is never going to happen to you. He's trying to turn him away from that cross. When else did this happen? When we think of this, when else did this happen? Remember Matthew 4, the Spirit leads Jesus out in the wilderness. And what does Satan try to do? Satan goes out to him and tries to tempt him. He says, I'll give you the kingdoms of the earth, and you won't need to have to go to that cross. All you have to do is worship me, and we can forget the whole cross thing. We can forget the suffering. We can forget the ignominious death on the cross. We can forget the resurrection. You forget all that. I'll give you the kingdoms. And now we have Peter. Look what Peter says. He says, this is never going to happen to you. He says, Peter is telling Jesus, trying to steer him away from God's plan and purpose. The whole reason he came in his earthly ministry was to go to that cross, where he would be Israel's redeemer, where he would redeem his friends in accord with Israel's prophetic program, in accord with that Davidic covenant. Now, if you want to know how God redeems his enemies, you have to go to Paul for that. The Gospels and the Old Testament and the epistles and of non-Pauline epistles, they tell you how God redeems his friends. Paul tells you how he redeems his enemies, how he makes you a friend in the first place. And so Peter comes along and he's trying to steer him away. He's the mouth of Satan. Look what Jesus says, if you don't believe me. Verse 23, we're finishing up in Matthew 16. But he turned and said unto Peter, this is Jesus speaking to Peter, get thee behind me, Satan. See, Peter is just talking like Satan back in Matthew 4 in the wilderness, trying to steer him away from that cross. Peter says, you're not going to that cross. It will never happen to you. Not on my watch. No way, no how. And Jesus turns and says, get thee behind me, Satan. You are an offense unto me, for thou savorest not the things that be of God, but those that be of men. See, that's the problem. Peter isn't listening to Jesus. He's listening to men. And Satan takes those truths. Remember our parable of the sower? What happens if you don't receive the truths of Jesus and instead reject them? What does the seed do? What does the word of the kingdom do? What it wants to do is fall on the prepared ground of faith where it will root, grow, and produce fruit. But if the ground isn't prepared in faith, then that seed of the kingdom, the word of the kingdom, comes, hits the hard ground, bounces around a little, and what happens? Satan comes and takes that word, twists it, perverts it, turns it inside out, and then uses it against Christ and his people. That's that vain religious system, the leaven, parable of the leaven. The teachings of that vain religious system. So Peter's not listening in faith. Peter rebukes Jesus, trying to turn him away from his suffering, death, and resurrection, as Satan did in the wilderness back in Matthew 4. Jesus responds with, get thee behind me, Satan. You value the things of men rather than God. Okay, now that sets the framework. We had to review that first because now you're going to see several other episodes and it's going to follow the same pattern. So we went to the next section, the first verses of chapter 17, verses 1 through 7. And what did we have there? We developed this the last couple of weeks, so I'm just bringing it up to bring your memory. We're not going to read through the whole thing, but we had there that transfiguration account. And what happens in the transfiguration account? Jesus takes Peter, James, and John, three of the 12, and he goes up in a mountain. Why? So they could pray. But what happens to Peter, James, and John? What do? They fall asleep. Great lesson on prayer. Prayer is talking to God about his things. They just rejected God's things when they said, this will never happen to you. They rejected Jesus' teaching about his upcoming sufferings, death, and resurrection. They didn't have anything to pray God about. And they just fall asleep. Then Peter wakes up, and what does he see? He sees Elijah and Moses and Jesus talking, all in their glorified state, glorified with kingdom glory. He sees them talking, and what are they talking about? What Peter and the 12 should have been talking to Jesus about before, Elijah, Moses, and Jesus are talking about. They're talking about his upcoming death, suffering and death in Jerusalem. Peter wakes up, and Peter, James, and John wake up, and Peter has this great idea. He says, he's still trying to figure out a way to get Jesus out of his death on the cross, suffering and death on the cross. And he says, this is great. Maybe Jesus is getting some new communication here. Let's set up tabernacles. Maybe he can die like Elijah. You know, Elijah had the best death of all, right? You know why? Because he didn't die. It wasn't even a death. He was just taken up. Maybe Jesus could go that route. He could just be taken up by God. Or maybe Jesus, instead of going to the cross, could just die like Moses, who had a long, fruitful life, and he's still vibrant and energetic at the end of his life. Maybe Jesus could die like that and not have to go to the cross. So Peter sets up tabernacles. He's still trying to figure out a way to make a way for Jesus not to go to that cross. And what happens in the middle of that? Peter doesn't even finish his thought And what happens? The cloud comes down, engulfs Moses and Elijah, gets them out of the scene. And the voice comes and says, "This is my beloved son. Listen to him." They're still not listening to Jesus. Peter's still trying to figure out a way to avoid the cross. And that brings us up to our section for today. So Peter, in the transfiguration accounts, he offers to make tabernacles of divine communication, opening up the possibility of Jesus dying like Elijah, who didn't die at all, or like Moses, who died in a ripe old age honorably. And he's trying to lead Jesus away from that cross. He's thinking of any other way other than the cross. And it's just, he's not listening. God's response, listen to him. So now that sets up the suspense. Is he going to listen? So now they come down from the mountain. And this is where we really pick it up for today. Now they come down the mountain. Last week we did some preparatory work about this secrecy component. And this whole Elijah and John the Baptist, the messenger from Malachi 3 and Elijah from Malachi 4 being mixed up. So they did that last week. We're not going to get into that again. But what we're going to look at this week is that another example of Peter's and Peter, James, and John's unbelief. They're still not listening. They come down the mount. They come down, and the question is, are they going to listen? Are they going to think according to Christ? Are they going to embrace his upcoming suffering at the hands of his own people, to die an ignominious, dishonoring death on the cross, and then be raised again from the dead? Remember, Peter, James, and John didn't have a problem understanding what death means. They saw that all around them. And they didn't really have a hard time understanding resurrection. They knew what to be raised from the dead is. What they didn't understand, what they weren't listening to, is why Jesus, the Christ, the Son of the living God, needed to be raised from the dead. Why Jesus the Christ, the Son of the living God, needed to go to a death on a cross. That's what they weren't understanding. That's what they needed to start listening to. So let's pick it up there, verse 9. And as they came down from the mountain, Jesus charged them, saying, "Tell this vision to no man until the Son of Man be risen again from the dead." And that's that secrecy component. We've dealt with that in the past with regard to God keeping, especially that wicked generation, in ignorance, so that when he gets to the cross, he can pray a prayer for them that reduces their charge from murder to manslaughter. They didn't know what they were doing. They did it in ignorance. See, and for under the law, the murder has no exceptions. Convicted of murder, stoned to death. End of story. But under the law, there is a provision for manslaughter. And you could flee to a city of refuge. And after the resurrection, the risen Christ is going to set up a city of refuge in Jerusalem under the ministry of Peter and the 12 and the Holy Spirit. And he's going to give the nation another chance to receive him. So that's one aspect for that ignorance, that secrecy concept. But then after Peter's confession, we brought out a second aspect. That's that Antichrist movement. When Peter confessed Jesus is the Christ, the Son of the living God, what immediately happens? Satan goes to work in and through Peter, and Peter rebukes Jesus. It sets up an Antichrist attack. It's going to now intensify Satan's policy of evil against the nation of Israel and against the believing remnant. So that's another reason for the secrecy. He doesn't want to inflame the Antichrist movement. This Antichrist movement at this point. This Antichrist movement is going to reach its high point when? In the middle of that tribulation period, when the man of sin goes and sits in that temple and claims to be the one true God. And then guess who's going to show up on the scene? Elijah. And he's going to say, the time for wavering is over. You're either with God or you're against God. You're either with the Christ or you're with the Antichrist. But Jesus doesn't want to inflame that at this point. He's still after his resurrection. That's going to not do anything to inflame that. We'll see that a couple times here. And so that's the secrecy component. We've dealt with that several times in the past. Let's go to verse 10. And his disciples asked him, saying, why then say the scribes that Elijah must first come? Now this has to hit us, right? This is like a smack across the face. They're coming down from the mountain where God just told them, gave them this transfigure experience and glory, and told them the only one, they're not even supposed to listen to Moses and Elijah. The only one they're supposed to listen to is Jesus. They come down the mount, and what do they start talking to Jesus about? What they heard the scribes say. This is a smack in the face. They're still not getting it. They're not supposed to be listening to the scribes. Who are the scribes? Go back to 16, verse 21. Let's see who the scribes are. From that time forth began Jesus to show unto his disciples how that he must go to Jerusalem and suffer many things. At whose hands is he going to suffer? At the elders and the chief priests and who? The scribes. Now they have this wonderful transfiguration experience. They come down the mount, and what do they? They should start talking to Jesus about his upcoming suffering, death, and resurrection. Instead, what do they start talking to him about? What the scribes are saying. They're listening to the scribes. They're still not listening to Jesus. They're listening to the ones who are that vain religious system, the ones who are going to put Christ to death on that cross. And his disciples asked him, why then say the scribes that Elijah must come first? And we looked at this before. Jesus begins, this is them confusing the messenger of Malachi 3 and the Elijah of Malachi 4. Jesus is going to explain that here. Look at verse 11. And Jesus answered and said unto them, Elijah truly shall come first and then restore all things. Elijah's going to come first at the point when it's time to restore all things. But that's not happening now. So let's see what else Jesus says. Verse 12. But I say unto you that Elijah has already come. Well, Jesus, how can Elijah be coming in the future and how can he have already come in the past? What does he say here? And they knew him not, but have done unto him whatsoever they listed. Likewise shall also the Son of Man suffer of them. Then the disciples understood that he spoke of John the Baptist. That's the sense Elijah has come in the person of John the Baptist. John the Baptist wasn't the Elijah of Malachi 4 who's going to come before the restoration of all things to cast a curse upon the earth. He's the messenger of Malachi 3 that's going to come before the forerunner to prepare a people unto the Lord. He comes in the angel's revelation to Zacharias, and when he's prophesying, he explains John the Baptist comes in the spirit and the power of Elijah, not to cast a curse upon the earth. That's what Elijah's going to do out in those end times. He's come to prepare a people for the Lord. And look how this all comes back. Look how Jesus doesn't let Peter get off the track here. So this is what Peter's thinking. Peter's thinking, okay, the scribes say, now he's not even supposed to be listening to the scribes. All the way back into the Sermon on the Mount, Jesus has been telling them, don't listen to the vain religious system. Don't listen to the scribes and the Pharisees and all those. You separate from those. Don't listen to them. Gives a whole parable, the parable of the leaven, that talks about, in that parable of the leaven, he explains that he's talking about the false teaching of that vain religious system. And he says, don't follow them. Now you get here after the transfiguration, and all they can find to talk about, they couldn't find anything to talk about with God the Father because they rejected Jesus' teaching. And now they get off the mount after this transfiguration. All they can talk about is what the scribes say. And Jesus isn't going to let them off the hook. Jesus is thinking. This is what Peter is thinking. Well, if the scribes are right... Let's just think, follow the logic here. If the scribes are right and Elijah comes first and then there's the restoration of all things, well, we just saw Elijah up on the mountain. We just saw him up there. Elijah's come. Next is the restoration of all things. Jesus isn't going to have to go to that death on the cross. The next thing is the restoration of all things. And Jesus explains, no, that's not what's happening now. And then look how Jesus doesn't let him off the hook. Verse 12. But I say unto you that Elijah has come already, and they knew him not. Look what he brings Peter and James and John back to. He brings them back to his sufferings at the hands of the scribes and Pharisees, the ignominious death on the cross, and his resurrection. Look what he says here. The end of verse 12 here, that Elijah is come already, and they knew him not. And what did they do to John the Baptist? They did whatever they wanted. Says he said, they done unto him whatsoever they listed, whatever they wanted. And we know he suffered and was put to death. Likewise shall the Son of Man suffer of them. He doesn't let Peter off the hook. Peter's still missing it. Don't listen to the scribes. Don't think according to man's wisdom. Remember, that's what he said in verse 16:23 at the very end there. He said, Peter, you're not savoring the things of God. You're savoring the things of men. You're not thinking God's way. You're thinking man's way. And Jesus isn't going to let him off the hook. Don't think according to men. Don't listen to the scribes. Don't come up with your own plans. Don't listen to Satan's policy. Don't listen to any of that. Listen to him, Jesus, the Christ, the Son of the living God. Listen to him. Peter, James, and John still aren't listening. That's the three that were up in the mountain with him. Now we're going to go through the rest of the chapter, and we're going to see two other groups and examples of people not listening to Jesus. All right, so here we have in 9-13, we have Peter, James, and John think that if their vain religious system is right and Elijah was to come first and then the restoration of all things, well, they just saw Elijah up in the mountain. Therefore, God will bring restoration of all things without Christ, suffering and death. And Jesus takes them right back. Remember John? Remember what they did to him? They're going to do the same to me. He doesn't let them off the hook. So that's the unbelief of the three. The unbelief of Peter, James, and John. They're still clinging to the teaching of this vain religious system who have tried to do away with John's and Jesus' ministry by confusing the two messengers in Malachi 3. And I would suggest that you have more explanation of those parables. I don't believe the parables in chapter 13 are just a set of parables and have nothing to do with anything else. We've seen they flow into 14, 15, 16, and now we see it in chapter 17. He's talking about the parable. They should have learned to not listen to the teachings of that vain religious system, the scribes. They're not supposed to be listening to them. They're supposed to be listening to Jesus. And instead, they're rebuking and ignoring Jesus and listening to the scribes and listening to their own man-made thoughts and desires. Parable of the leaven. I'd suggest we've already talked about the parable of the sower, right? Jesus teaches them. He gives them the word of the kingdom. And instead of it landing on the prepared ground that allows it to root, grow, and bear fruit, what happens? It just hits their heads and bounces away. And what happens? Satan comes. He takes that word, he twists it, he turns it, he pulls it inside out, wraps it around, and then he gives it to that vain religious system, and Peter's become a tool of that. He's rebuking the Lord. This will never happen to you. No matter what it requires, I'm going to find some creative way so you don't have to go to the cross. It's taken that parable of the sower, parable of the leaven. Let's look at another parable now. Verse 14. This is Matthew 17, verse 14. All right. So Peter's not listening here, and we bring out the sower concept. And let's look at the unbelief of what I call the unbelief of the nine now. Verse 14. And then when they were come to the multitude. All right, so now you got the three, right? Remember, Jesus went up into the mount with the three, Peter, James, and John. It's kind of early for me to engage in in-depth mathematics, but since there's 12 and three went up the mountain, just some quick arithmetic, I can guess there's nine left on the valley, down in the valley, in the plain. Nine are down there, three go up, nine are down there. And let's see what they were doing while Peter, James, and John was up in the mount. And when, verse 14, they were come to the multitude, there came to him a certain man kneeling down to him and saying, Lord, have mercy on my son, for he is lunatic and sore vexed, and for oftentimes he falleth into the fire and oft into the water. And I brought him to thy disciples. Now remember, this is the nine. The three are up on the mount. The nine that remain down on the ground. Then Jesus answered, verse 16, and I brought them to thy disciples, and they could not cure him. Then Jesus answered and said, O faithless and perverse generation, how long shall I be with you? How long shall I suffer you? Bring him here to me. So now we have Jesus. He's been here. This is about 2 years. He's got about a year or so left. And he's been there a long time, and they're still not listening. But what's more important, he's also hinting he's not going to be there much longer. He's not going to be there much longer. And this person comes. They come down the mountain, and the nine that were down in the valley can't cast out the devil or heal the son of this man. Now, not too long before this, they were sent out. They were healing the sick. They were casting out devils. They were doing all that. They come down the mount now, and they find out the nine couldn't cast out this devil, couldn't heal this son. And the question is why? Well, one reason is there's been an intensification of Satan's policy of evil, that whole Antichrist concept after Peter's confession of Christ, Jesus is the Christ, the Son of the living God. And they come down this mount, there's an intensification of Satan's policy of evil against the nation, and the nine can no longer counteract it. So we got to ask, why are the nine not able to do what they were able to do a few chapters before this? Why? I think we can all guess it's because they're not listening to Jesus. And we'll see that as we go through here. Verse 14, so they come down, and the multitude came to him, a certain man kneeling down to him and saying, Lord, have mercy on my son. As soon as you hear a phrase like that with mercy in there, first thing that should come to your mind is the Davidic covenant. That's the key word of the Davidic covenant for the nation of Israel, hesed, that mercy concept, steadfast loving kindness. Verse 15, Lord, have mercy on my son, for he is lunatic, sore vexed, and oftentimes he falls into the fire and oftentimes into the water. And I brought him to thy disciples, and they could not cure him. And now look at Jesus' response. He's going to answer two different ways. First, he's going to draw attention to the state of the apostate nation. Then he's going to draw attention to the state of the nine, his nine disciples, his nine apostles here. Then Jesus answered and said, Oh, faithless generation. So we got to look at that faithless generation. We've heard this phrase before. We've read this not too long ago. Does anyone remember where? Back in chapter 16, when Jesus said, on this rock, this confession of Peter, who announced that the rock was with them, Jesus is the Christ, the Son of the living God. He is the rock. And where did we go? Let's go back to Deuteronomy 32. And I've been dying to say this. We're going to listen to some rock music. All right, it kind of worked. We're going to go to Deuteronomy 32, the Song of Moses. Remember, we went in great detail at this in Matthew 16, right after the confession of Peter. And we're going to take a look at this. We went through, I think, basically the whole song. It's called the Song of Moses here. Many people call it the Song of the Rock, because that's the subject matter. It's the rock, God the rock. And God the rock, Peter identifies as the Lord Jesus Christ. All right, so let's just look at this idea, this faithless and perverse generation. See, when he says generation, you know, we should probably do one thing. Keep your finger in Deuteronomy and go back to Matthew 1. Just Matthew 1. That should be real easy to find. Matthew 1. And I just want to make a comment on this generation concept. Generation, you know, we tend to think of a generation, here's all different, you know, 33 years, 36 years, 40 years, whatever people come up for what they think a generation is, a period of time. That's not what Matthew's talking about here. He's talking about a generation that's happened way in the past and is still going on in Jesus' day. And kind of more of the idea what's in Matthew 1:1. Matthew 1:1. Keep your finger in Deuteronomy 32. We're going right back there. But this generation concept, the book, Matthew 1:1, the book of the generation of Jesus Christ. So he's not talking about Jesus' life there, his generation, you know, with 40 years or 50 years or whatever a generation is. He's talking about something that goes all the way back to Abraham. So now we go to Deuteronomy 32. We have to understand that when Jesus talks in Matthew 17 about this perverse and wicked generation, he's not just talking about the people alive at that time and during that time frame. He's talking about a line of people that go all the way back to the wilderness wanderings. They're a line of people that go all the way back to Moses, what Moses talked about in the wilderness. And I'd suggest this, we won't look at it now, I'd suggest that based on some other scriptures, this generation goes all the way back to Cain. There's a generation, an unrighteous generation that's gone through through Israel's prophetic program. And that's been one line. Then there's a line, the generation of the righteous. And so now, with that in mind, we're going to find what Jesus taught about. As soon as he said to these Jews, a perverse and faithless generation, they would have immediately remembered Deuteronomy 32. Let's just pick it up at verse 4. Deuteronomy 32, verse 4. He is the rock. We just had Jesus talking about that in Matthew 16. His work is perfect, for all his ways are judgment, a God of truth and without iniquity, just and right is he. Now look what Moses says next. They, now he's talking about the people, some of the people anyway, they have corrupted themselves. Their spot is not the spot of his children. They are a perverse and crooked generation. Does that sound a little like a faithless and perverse generation? This is when Jesus is talking about his generation, he is talking about the people of that day that make up the apostate nation, but it's not just of his day, it goes all the way back to the wilderness wine. Something that sprung up then that he's talking about. Now let's look at the faithless aspect. Go down to verse 20. Verse 20. And he said, this is Moses speaking, and he said, I will hide my face from them. This is the Lord speaking. I will see what their end shall be, for they are a froward. That's Old English. Probably one way of explaining it is just rebellious, a rebellious generation, children in whom is no faith. Jesus takes these two together, these two verses and our Song of the Rock, and he puts them together in Matthew 17. And the same generation Moses was talking about back there, this perverse and faithless generation. has been winding its way through Israel's prophetic program all the way to Jesus, and it's still active in his day. All right, let's go back to Matthew 17. Matthew 17. So he says in verse 17, Matthew 17, verse 17, he calls them this faithless and perverse, rebellious generation that goes all the way back to Moses and the wilderness wanderings. So that's the apostate nation, this faithless and perverse generation from Deuteronomy. What was their main problem? Why were they perverse? Why were they faithless? They weren't listening to the Lord. And what's the whole problem he's addressing here? People not listening to the Lord. And that's what we're coming to here now. So he brings that out. And now let's look at the disciples' unbelief. So that's the apostate nation as a whole. And look at verse 18 now. And Jesus rebuked the devil. See, Jesus doesn't have any problem casting him out. He rebukes the devil, and he departed out of him, and the child was cured from that very hour. So let's go over, let's look at another account of this, because I think it adds some additional flavor to this. Go over to Mark 9, verse 21. This is the same account, except Mark gives us some other details that he's writing about here. So look at Mark 9, let's pick it up at verse 21, so you can see it's the same account here. In chapter 9 opens up in Mark with that transfiguration account. They come down the mount. It's the same situation we have in our Matthew account. Let's pick it up at let's look at verse 19. He answered and said, "O faithless generation, how long shall I be with you?" We just read about that in Matthew 17. Verse 21, and he asked his father, "How long is it ago since this came unto him?" And he said, "Of a child. And oftentimes he hath cast himself in the fire and into the waters to destroy him." This devil is tormenting this person. Throwing, and the father probably has to sit there, and he throws him in the fire. The father gets him out. He throws him in the water. He pulls him up from drowning. It's tormenting him. See, this has gone beyond some of the devil accounts, many of the devil accounts we had before. Some have been similar to this, but many weren't like this. There's an intensification of Satan's activity when they come down that mount. There's an intensification. And look at verse, he's throwing himself in the fire, throwing himself in the water, verse 22. "But if thou canst do anything, have compassion on us and help us." And the man's father says, "If you can do anything, do it." Now look at Jesus' response. He says, Jesus said, the man tried to put everything on Jesus. And what does Jesus do? Like a hot potato, he throws it right back to the man. Look what he says. He says, Jesus said unto him, "If thou canst believe." The problem isn't if I can do it or not. The problem is, can you believe or not? Jesus, or the man, tried to throw the responsibility on Jesus, and Jesus takes it and throws it right back to him. Can you believe? Can you listen to me and believe? And then what does the man say? And Jesus says, "All things are possible to him that believeth." And straightway the father of the child cried out and said in tears, "Yes, I believe, Lord. Help thou mine unbelief. I believe, and help me in anything I don't believe." Now what is Jesus? Now what's Jesus' response? When Jesus saw that the people came running together, he rebuked the foul spirit, saying unto him, "Thou dumb and deaf spirit, I charge thee, come out of him and enter no more into him." And the spirit cried and rent him sore and came out of him. He wasn't going to come without a fight, was he? He didn't even care if that person died. He didn't want to leave. Jesus comes and casts him out, and he's still fighting to keep him. And look what verse 26, "And the spirit cried and rent him sore and came out of him, and he was as one dead, insomuch that many said, 'He is dead.' But Jesus took him by the hand, lifted him up, and he arose. And here we have this little mini picture of what's going to happen in those end times at Christ's return. Satan's policy of evil is going to reach its climax against that believing remnant and the nation of Israel. He's going to have his claws in them, and he's not going to let them go without a fight. It's going to be a struggle. His policy of evil is going to keep on intensifying, intensifying, intensifying. Remember, he gets cast out of heaven. He comes to earth. And does it say he, with his tail between his legs, he went and hid in a cave? No. What is he? He comes down to the earth and he's full of wrath and anger. He's going to destroy everything rather than let Israel go back, go to God. So we have a little mini picture here, perhaps, of what's going to happen in the end time, a kind of little picture of that. Let's go over to Matthew 17. All right, so this is the disciples' unbelief. Let's pick it up this same account, but now we'll read it, finish reading it in Matthew. And the disciples came unto him, verse 19. Matthew 17, verse 19. Then came the disciples to Jesus apart and said, now these are the nine, remember? The nine, why could we not cast him out? And Jesus said unto them, because of your unbelief. They weren't listening. He's going all the way back to that verse we started the message with, Matthew 16, 29. He tried to teach them about the necessity of his suffering at the hands of his own people, his ignominious death on the cross, and his resurrection from the dead. They're still not listening. They're not keeping up with the program. Now look how he describes it now. And I'm just going to ask, everybody think of the parables and see if this is reminiscent of a parable we read back in Matthew 13. And Jesus said, verse 20, unto them, because of your unbelief. For verily I say unto you, if ye have faith as a grain of mustard seed. Does that remind you of a parable? That parable where God's going to take something the size of a grain of a mustard seed and turn it into something great. If you have the faith, just like that, God can do this. If you believe what Jesus is saying, if you start listening to him, the context here is they would have no problem casting out the devil and healing the young man. But they weren't listening to Jesus in faith. And that stalled them, that prevented them from going on with the increasing intensification of Satan's policy of evil against the nation here and the nation, and didn't give them the power they needed then to keep up with the intensifying, Satan's intensifying policy of evil against them. But he said, if you just believe in that, well, the thing they need to believe is that thing about the death and resurrection of Christ, the suffering, death, and resurrection of Christ. Just a little bit of faith would grow into something great, and they would have had no problem casting out the devil and healing the man. Howbeit, so remove hence. He talks about the mountain. It would be enough to remove a mountain hence to yonder place, and it shall remove, and nothing shall be impossible to you. They would have been able. If they listened and embraced in faith, Matthew 16, 21, they would have been able to cast out the devil. Even with his intensification of his activity against that man, he had cast him out and healed him. But they weren't keeping up with the revelation and the teaching Jesus is giving them. They're not listening yet. And look what he says in verse 21. Howbeit this kind goeth not out by prayer and fasting. And it's worth, I always like remembering, you know, these passages just don't drop out of the middle of the blue sky, and Matthew doesn't know why he wrote this here. It could be for any reason, you know, he didn't know. These all are tied together. Everything works together. And it's interesting, here he talks about prayer and fasting. You know, he talked about prayer elsewhere, but you know what he ruled out earlier? Fasting. He ruled it out. Go back to Matthew 9. Go back to Matthew 9, verse 15. He's spent a lot of time in these early chapters about prayer, but he ruled out fasting. Let's see why. Look at Matthew 9, verse 14. Matthew 9, verse 14. Then came to him the disciples of John, saying, "Why do we and the Pharisees fast often? But thy disciples," Jesus' disciples, "fast not." Fast, Jesus didn't allow them to fast. Why? Verse 15. And Jesus said unto them, "Can the children of the bride chamber mourn?" He puts it in a marriage context, a marriage ceremony context, a banqueting context. And Jesus said, "Can the children of the bride chamber mourn as long as the bridegroom is with them?" And of course, the implied answer is no. You don't go to a wedding ceremony and spend your time crying and mourning. Right? You go to a wedding ceremony, and what are you doing? You're rejoicing and banqueting. The bridegroom, Israel's bridegroom, was here on site. It was a time for rejoicing and banqueting, not mourning and fasting. But there is coming a day. When is that? For not just prayer, but prayer and fasting. Look what he says at the end of verse 15. He says, "But the days will come when the bridegroom shall be taken away from them." So what's he come when he talks about fasting? And if you remember what Matthew said about fasting, what's fasting indicate? It indicates the time when Jesus is going to be removed from them. See, he just keeps bringing them back to his suffering, death, and resurrection. When he's going to be removed from them, then it'll be time not just for prayer. It's always time for prayer, unless you're not listening to Jesus, and then you'll just fall asleep during your prayer time. But it's always important to pray in accord with God and his plans and purposes. But fasting won't be until Jesus is taken away. And how's he going to be taken away? Suffering, death, resurrection. He's going to be exalted in glory. And he's going to go away and then begin that work at Pentecost through send the Holy Spirit through the ministry of Peter and the 12. All right, so let's go back here. So the point of what I'm trying to get at there is Matthew 17:21 indicates that this is going to be especially relevant in what they're going to need out in that tribulation period when the Lord isn't there with them. All right, now, just to keep the trail of thought here, in Matthew 16, I must go to Jerusalem, suffer, die, be raised again the third day. Peter does what? "No way, Lord. That's never happened unto you, not on my watch." Get to the transfiguration. Is Peter listening yet? He wakes up, because he falls asleep when he should be praying. He wakes up, hears Elijah, Moses, and Jesus talking about what? What they should have been talking to Jesus about. Elijah, Moses, and Jesus are talking about his upcoming death, his upcoming suffering and death in Jerusalem. And instead of joining with that conversation, Peter comes up with a great idea. Let's set up tabernacles, and maybe Jesus, there can be a divine communication, and Jesus won't need to go to a suffering death on the cross, an ignominious, dishonorable death. Maybe he can die like Elijah and just be taken up. Or maybe he can die like Moses in a ripe old age, and just God will take him away and bury him. And Peter's still not listening. God the Father comes and removes everybody from the scene, but Jesus says, "Listen to him." Then they come down the mount. And when they're supposed to be listening to Jesus, Peter says, "Well, I've been listening to the scribes. And this is what they say, blah, blah, blah." And Jesus, you see, they're still not listening. And if what they say is right, then Jesus, Elijah came. We just saw him on the mount. Now their days of restoration are going to come, and you don't need to go to that cross. They're still not listening. Then we have the apostate nation. It's not listening. And the nine, we find out they aren't listening. And they're not able, because of that, they're not able to keep up with, if they're not keeping up with God's program, they're not going to be able to keep up with Satan's increasing, intensifying policy of evil against them. He says, remember the parable of the sower. Remember the parable of the leaven. Remember the parable of the mustard seed. He's like, I didn't teach you chapter 13 just so you could forget it. You need to remember those things, operate in accord with it, and you'd be able to cast out that devil. You'd have been able to heal that man. And now, with all that, all the wrangling, all the thinking according to men instead of according to God, look how Jesus ends it for them. He doesn't let them off the hook. Verse 17:22. And while they abode in Galilee, so now we're back to all 12, right? We've seen the unbelief of the three, the unbelief of the nine. Now we've got the 12. He's got them all together again. And look what he tells them. He doesn't let them off the hook. He says, Peter, you can come up with all your man-made wrangling, all your ideas, all your avenues for me not to go to that cross. It doesn't matter. I'm going to that cross. Verse 22, and while they abode in Galilee, Jesus said unto them, the Son of Man shall be betrayed into the hands of men. He's like, I'm going to say it one more time, and you better listen this time. And they shall kill him, and the third day he shall be raised again. And they were exceeding sorry. So now we have the 12. He's not going to let them off the hook. There's no other route for Jesus but to go to Jerusalem, suffer at the hands of his own people, suffer an ignominious, dishonorable death on that cross, and then be raised again on the third day. Let's finish up by looking. Now he's going to pick up the apostate nation. One more example of unbelief. One more example of unbelief. Unbelief of the nation. And then we'll wrap up chapter 17 and get into chapter 18 next week. And when they were come to Capernaum, they received tribute money. Now, it's easy to confuse this with the idea of Caesar. You remember giving to Caesar, what's due Caesar and all that. This isn't what he's talking about in this account. This is the tribute money. This is the temple tax. This is the money that every male Jew, when they turned 20, was expected to start paying. This temple tax. It's to support the temple and its work. And so it's a Jewish tax, something that he's talking about here, this temple tax. All right, so and when they were come to Capernaum, they that received the tribute money, now who would it be that's receiving the temple money, the tribute money for the temple? Who would it be? It'd be representatives of that vain religious system. The Pharisees, the Sadducees, the scribes, the chief priests, all that. These are their representatives. And they come out and they ask Peter if they're going to pay the temple tax. Now, this is a slight. See, no other master with his disciples would they have treated this way. They should have gone to the master. Instead, they go to the disciple of the master. And they go to Peter instead of the master. And then what becomes evident then is that they're not listening and believing Jesus either. They're part of that apostate nation because if they believed, they would have gone to the master. Instead, what are they trying to do? They're trying to trip up the disciple so they can catch the master in a trap and bring a charge against them. The law required the payment of this temple tax. Maybe they'll go to Peter, get him to say something he shouldn't, and we can trap the master and accuse him of breaking the law. Verse 25, and he said, yes. Peter just answers yes. He doesn't consult Jesus or anything. He just says yes, and he's joining right along in this attempt to ensnare Jesus in the violation of the law. And he said, yes, verse 25. And when he was come into the house, Jesus prevented him, saying, what thinkest thou, Simon? So now he's going to try to guide Simon's thinking. Of whom do the kings of the earth take custom or tribute? Of their own children or of strangers? And Peter answered, strangers. So he gives him a little lesson here. The lesson is he uses the idea of kings. And of course, Jesus is the king, right? He uses the idea of kings here. Do they pay taxes to themselves? No. Strangers, those outside the family, pay the tax to support the king and his family. And of course, the idea is Jesus is the, remember, we read this earlier too, he's greater than the temple. And he comes on the scene, and he's showing Peter he doesn't need to pay the tax either, and his followers don't. They're supporting he's the Lord of the temple. He's the God of the temple. But look what he says here. Notwithstanding, here we get that secrecy, that kind of keeping in ignorance thing. Verse 27. Notwithstanding, lest we should offend them, go thou to the sea, cast in a hook, take up the fish that first cometh, and when thou hast opened his mouth, thou shalt find a piece of money, take it and give it unto them from me and thee. They didn't have to pay that tax because the king was there with his family. Remember, the very end of Matthew 12, who's my family? It's his followers, his spiritual family, the generation he generated through his words and his ministry here in the first part of Matthew. That's the generation, that's his children. But he wasn't going to make a point of it now because he didn't want to offend them. He didn't want to give them any way to inflame that anti-Christ movement, that anti-Jesus movement, whereby they could in any way try to lay a charge against him by breaking the law with regard to the temple tax. He said, this is not a battle we're going to fight now. And he says, go ahead and pay the tax. And he provides the money supernaturally. All right, then we're going to go into chapter 18. There's going to be a little change of emphasis. This whole idea of unbelief, this whole idea of not listening to Jesus. Now in chapter 18, he's going to show why it's so important and give some other characteristics that these disciples are going to need to have for enduring that tribulation period.